Hi, this is Christine Catherine Rush, author of Diving Into the Wreck, and you're listening to the SF Signal podcast.
This is the SF Signal podcast as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name's Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight, we get to sit down with Christine Catherine Rush. And by we, I mean John DiNardo, Jeff Patterson, and myself. We get to geek out and go fanboy with the author of so many different novels, I couldn't even count them all. So without further ado, let's get on to the interview with Christine Catherine Rush, who's also a Batman fan, by the way. And tonight we have the honor of sitting down with a Hugo Award-winning author who is very prolific, by the way. I think I counted, I started counting all your books, and I stopped around 417, because I just can't count any higher than that. But we have Christine Catherine Rush with us. Hi.
Hi.
Also,
you scared me with that 417, I tell you.
Well, there's a lot of books, and I knew that you had done some in other universes like Star Wars and Star Trek. I did not know that you had done X-Men and Quantum Leap and Aliens and Predator, for example. So that's really cool. I also have tonight with me John DiNardo.
Hello.
And Jeff Patterson.
Greetings.
And before I let them get going, I just wanted to ask you, when you work in those other universes, I mean, I've asked different people this before because we've had a couple of different authors who have gotten to play in these other universes before. What was your experiences like? I mean, is it very different if you get to write in, say, Star Trek versus X-Men?
Yes, it's real different. It depends on who your editor is and who the licensor is, the person at licensing. And it also depends on the attitude they have toward their property. Sometimes it's a lot of fun. Star Trek was a lot of fun. That's one of the reasons that Dean and I did so many. And sometimes it's a real nightmare. And I'm not going to say which one was the nightmare.
And just for our listeners' benefit, she's talking about Dean Wesley Smith.
That's my husband.
That's her husband. Why don't you tell us just briefly, give us a little bit of an insight. Who is Chris? Where did she come from?
Well, I'm from Wisconsin, actually. My entire family still lives in the Midwest. I was actually born in New York, and I like to say that my entire life was moving west because now I live on the Pacific Ocean. But the bulk of my growing up years were in Superior, Wisconsin, and Madison, Wisconsin, and that was highly influential for me, both places. And then I moved to Oregon when I was in my 20s. I wanted to be a writer since I was really little. I think mostly it was because it was a bid for attention. I was a surprise, as my parents like to say. And my siblings are all about 20 years older than me. And so my earliest memory is of five adults sitting in the living room reading books.
Wow.
And I couldn't read yet. Nobody would play with me and nobody would read to me. And so I think I became a writer in self-defense.
So, Jeff, did you want to go first? Do you have a question?
Yeah. If I could jump right to Retrieval Artist.
Sure.
Over the holidays, I read the book How to Disappear by Frank M. Ahern, which was a book about removing your digital footprint and basically vanishing from people you want to get away from.
Oh, it's a book I've been wanting to read. I have it sitting here, and I haven't read it yet.
I read it and kept going through my mind. Every time I got to a chapter, I kept thinking of a scene out of a Retrieval Artist book. So my question was, in that series specifically, what kind of research did you have to do? I mean, there had to be some footwork to come up with some of the techniques that you had in there, that some of the plot points hinged on.
Well, I'm a huge mystery reader, and I got really intrigued a long time ago. I read that quote from Isaac Asimov that said that it's almost impossible to write good science fiction and good mystery together. And I thought, well, that's a challenge. And, you know, I think almost everything I write has a little bit of a mystery in it. And a lot of it came from my research for mystery fiction. And in mystery, I'm known as Chris Nelscott in my novels. And granted, those books are set in the 1960s, and it was a lot easier to disappear then. But it was something that really intrigued me. And I thought, you know, there are times when that's a real valuable valuable skill to have. So it's always been something that's intrigued me. As I said, I was interested in the Ahern book. I haven't read it yet. I read articles about it. I read books about it. It's not that I want to leave my own life, but I'm just always curious about people who do.
So, for the readers who aren't aware, can you tell us the premise of that series?
The Retrieval Artist series is a series that's set in a world that's based on the moon. It's not really entirely set on the moon. In the far future, and humans and aliens have formed what is called the Earth Alliance. And one of the agreements of the Earth Alliance is that should you commit a crime on alien territory, if the alien is a member of the Earth Alliance, then you are subject to their laws. And their laws are dramatically different than human laws. And in some cases, we don't consider either the crime or the law and the punishment fair. And so the corporations, which have moved all over the entire, you know, settled part of the universe, found a way to keep their most important employees and to get them to go to these alien places because they were afraid to go, and told them that if they did break a law, instead of being punished, and some of the punishments were severe, like taking your firstborn child, instead of being subject to the punishment, corporations would pay for you to disappear. And the hero of these books is a man who's called a retrieval artist. His job is to find people who have disappeared, not to help them get punished, but to tell them their punishment was waived or that they've inherited something or that someone they love died. And it's a real tricky, kind of subtle universe. And every now and then I have to really be careful to make sure that, you know, what my hero's actions do don't put some innocent person in jeopardy.
And you've got, is it 7 books in that series now?
Yeah, well, sort of. I'm in the middle of the 8th, and it'll be coming out later this year.
So mystery works into some of your other fiction as well. I read Diving the Wreck, which I loved. I thought was excellent. And that one started as a piece of short fiction in Asimov. I guess a series of short fiction stories, right?
Yes.
So how did that come about, and how did that evolve into a novel? And tell us about the upcoming sequel.
Well, there are 2 now. Most of my novels end up coming from short stories. I write short stories first, and then I think about it, and I think, ooh, you know, I didn't explore all the implications of that. And I write more. Diving into the Wreck, I knew it was really huge when I wrote the novella, the very first one. And I went over to Dean because I didn't think – I've often done this with Dean I'm going to back up for a second. When I went to Clarion in 1985, my Clarion class told me that I was not capable of writing science fiction and I should give it up.
Oh.
And so there is always a part of my brain that worries that, oh, no, can I write science fiction? And so when I come up with a really cool science fiction idea, I try to give it away. And I did Diving into the Wreck, and I got to the middle part of it that had to do with this fleet of ships that has been around for 5,000 years. And I went to Dean and I said, you want to write it? We could write it together. And he said, no, you get to write it. And I'm like, oh, no. So I knew it was big. I just didn't think I could tackle it. And it kept coming out in sideways stories, first in Diving into the Wreck, and then a story called The Room of Lost Souls, and another one called The Spires of Denon, which I still don't know how it fits. And then I started a story called City of Ruins, and I realized, oh, that's way in the future, and I have to finish the diving story first. So that's when I finished that novel and went, ah, that's what happens next. The next book is City of Ruins, which takes place 5 years after Diving into the Wreck. And most of the characters that you've met in Diving into the Wreck are there, but not all of them. It's a standalone book, and they're always on a quest for something called stealth technology, and Boss and her crew are kind of at odds with each other because they found hints of stealth technology on a planet, and Boss doesn't believe it would exist on a planet. But this planet has what are called death holes that just suddenly appear, you know, like underneath the city, like a sinkhole would, and they go to explore it, and things get worse. Of course things get worse because it's a book. And I finished that one, and now I'm writing the third one. It's called Boneyards, and it takes place 5 years after that.
Oh, I'm drooling hearing all this. I gotta tell you, when One with the Ghosts came out last year, I was reading it on the train to work and did not realize upon starting it that it was going to tie into that universe.
Yeah, so it does.
When Boss shows up, I was like, yay, it was, made me very happy.
Good.
The other question I had about that was, that is the story of yours out of all the ones that I've read that seems to be carrying the most baggage with it. It has such a backstory that is hinted at. And I'm wondering, as you got deeper into the series, did you decide to expand on the backstory just to add more mystery to it, or how did that come about?
No, I've known that I'm going to have to deal with the backstory. In fact, I have a story coming up in Asimov's real soon now. I'm not sure if it's the next double issue. It's sometime this spring, and it's called Be Calmed, and it's the entire backstory of Coop's ex-wife, actually, and how this entire war gets started. And it's not in any of the books yet. I do that a lot. I just write short stories to tell myself, how did they get here? Sometimes I stop the novel I'm writing and go, okay, I don't know how they got here. And instead of doing what a lot of writers do, which is kind of extra material in nonfiction sort of ways, notes to themselves, I just write another story. And it just, that way I can figure it out, because then the characters, this is what I call mystical writer's talk, but then the characters tell me something I wouldn't otherwise know.
Wow. Just so you know, Chris, whenever we have Jeff around and we're talking about books, usually at the end of the podcast, Jeff goes out and spends a lot of money.
That's good by me.
I'm spending money right now.
Our entire podcast is an elaborate plot to get him to spend money, pretty much.
Pretty much it. on a similar vein, in looking at your bibliography, and I see the various genres that you've played in, and I've read predominantly your science fiction, but I am curious, when you play in that many sandboxes, I'm interested in your relationship with fans of the various genres. Do you have to put on different airs when you're dealing with different aspects of fandom, or what?
I do have to clean up my language when I leave science fiction. But other than that, I pretty much don't, because I'm a fan of all the genres I write in. I didn't honestly know what a genre was until I met Kevin J. Anderson in college, and he explained them to me. Until that point, I thought everybody went to the bookstore and just took books out at random and read them. I had no idea that there were people who just made a beeline for a particular section of the bookstore and stayed there. So it was really hard, and it still is really hard to keep me in one genre. For example, my what's being marketed as romance under Christine Grayson are really fantasy novels. And they're goofy, they're silly, they're very different from the science fiction and fantasy in that they are goofy and silly. And as a reader, I don't like authors who write in many genres without giving me tells, because I have nightmares at night and I read before I go to sleep, and I don't read anything scary before I go to sleep. So if you're an author that, you know, will suddenly murder a kid in the middle of a book, I'm going to be really mad at you if I read it just before I went to bed. So the pen names are there not really necessarily for, you know, marketing purposes. They're kind of there as a guideline to my fans, saying, okay, if you read a Christine Grayson book, no child is going to get harmed, and it's going to be silly, and I promise nobody's skin is going to get ripped off. But I can't promise that with Rush. And I can't promise, you know, that something icky isn't going to happen with Nelscott, but I can promise that with Grayson.
You mentioned Kevin J. Anderson. We've actually chatted with him a couple times now. He's a really great guy.
Yeah, Kev's great.
You did a collaboration with him, and you've also done several collaborations with Dean. Can you just talk a little bit about that process for you and how collaborations work for you?
Collaborations are very different depending on who I collaborate with. Kev and I have known each other since college, like I said, and our relationship is kind of brother and sister. We've been best friends ever since we met, but in that kind of, you know, I stood up for him at his wedding and he was at mine, and, you know, we've known all each other's secrets. And so when we collaborated, we had to pick who was going to do the final draft. And I don't know if he told you this, but we actually had a fight, and we had one of those 2-year-old fights, you know, I'm the better writer. No, I'm the better writer. No, I'm the better writer. And I've never had that fight with anybody else in my life, and I don't think he has either. And by the end of it, we were just laughing and sitting in his office, just tears rolling down our faces, realizing how silly we sounded, because we had reverted to our inner 5-year-olds. But we did have to pick whoever was going to, you know, do the polished draft. And to be honest with you, I can't remember who did on either book. I think we traded off on the second book. But it was a completely different process than what Dean and I do. Dean and I could not brainstorm together, and we still can't, because we think about stories so differently. So what we ended up doing is Dean would do what we would call the proposal draft in a way. He would do about 100 pages of a 300-page book or 150 pages, and it would be all the plot. And then I would fill in the setting and the characters, and that would work. For the most part. Occasionally I would have to go to him and say, you know, no character would ever do this. And then I'd have to leave, because at that point we couldn't brainstorm what the character would do, because we would fight, and not in the fun, silly way that Kevin and I would, but in the way that a married couple fights. So we just learned that it was better, you know, one of us would do the plot draft and the other would do the fill-in draft. And since I was more interested in the fill-in draft than he was, I usually did that.
Hmm. Very cool. John, I think I interrupted you. You were going to ask something.
Yeah, about writing in the different genres. I was curious whether wearing those different hats is helpful, or does it hinder writing in the other genres? Do they feed into each other? Do you find elements of one genre leaking into another? Obviously, with mystery and sci-fi, they do. But do you see it elsewhere?
Yeah, they leak a lot. And I think that, again, it comes from my eclectic reading. But some of it is on the business side of writing. It really informs me a lot. So I'm not stuck in my genre. And I understand that, you know, I knew that YA was doing better than most people thought long before it permeated the cultural zeitgeist, just because I was reading a lot of YA, and I have a lot of friends who are writing YA, and I've got a YA novel that's underway also. You know, I'm always working on something different. But it gives me opportunities. If I write a character who's a young character in, say, my Faye series, I've been planning to write some young adult books about those younger characters, just because those characters have stories to tell, and then I get to pick what genre the various characters get to tell their stories in. Romance has been the hardest one for me, in the sense that my romances never fall along genre lines. They're very strange. I just have one that just came out as an ebook that I'm convinced is a romance and nobody else is. It's on my site right now. It's called The Death of Davy Moss. And Dean calls it a contemporary music novel. One of my former agents calls it women's fiction without the women. So every now and then I write a kind of genreless book.
How is that not science fiction if it's women's fiction?
Well, there are women in that book. It's just women's fiction focuses on emotions of the women in the story, and this book focuses on the emotions of the men in the story. Oops.
Jeff?
Wow. One of the running things that we end up talking about in a number of podcasts has always been shelf life and reissues and stuff like that. And I noticed on your site you had the link to the reissue of Hitler's Angel.
Well, yeah.
if it's really a reissue. And I'm just kind of curious, what is your take on that, given how, you know, what I tend to find is the trend of, used to be when a new book in a series came out, all the previous books in that series tended to get at least a limited re-release. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
It's not. And in fact, a lot of New York publishers will take books out of print before the entire series is done. And that has always been the case in mystery. But in science fiction, it's been a phenomenon of the last 10 years. And I think it's really frustrating for the readers and for the writers, because you can't grow your audience if book four of a series is out of print and you're writing books five and six. But I think that you're going to watch that change now with electronic publishing and with the rise of the specialty presses that are coming back. And a lot of writers are doing it themselves. They're putting their series back into print at smaller numbers than you would see out of traditional publishing, but big enough numbers to attract new fans all the time. And I think that's really valuable. It also gives us a lot of freedom as writers, and it gives us a lot of stuff to read as readers. I think it's great.
Yeah, Resnick talks about that quite a bit, because he's bringing a lot of his out-of-print books back. Just by doing them as Kindle.
Yeah, I've got 30 out-of-print novels.
Wow.
And I'm bringing them. They're all coming back this year. But the thing that has me the most excited is that, in addition to that, is that WMG Publishing is also doing all of my short fiction, or at least all of it that, you know, we can get our hands on electronic file. And, you know, may not all come out this year. It might take a couple more years. But, you know, I didn't think there was going to be much of a market for that. And electronically, there's a huge market for that. My short fiction, individual stories are selling at tremendous rates. And that surprised me. I thought that was just going to be kind of a vanity project. But it turns out, no, it's, you know, people are interested. And I'm really grateful for that. Hmm.
John. Micro-purchasing. The power
it is.
Of micro-purchasing.
Well, it's a lot like, I think of it kind of like iTunes, where you may not want to buy the entire album, but you want to buy a song off of it. And yep. A short story is a song.
Yep, absolutely.
I'll drop a dollar on a song without thinking twice.
I do, too. That's why now when I work on iTunes, I always work off of a gift certificate, because I don't dare tie it to my credit card anymore, because those dollars occasionally add up.
Well, and see, I've seen some of the posts on Twitter that John's done about the music that he listens to, so he's willing to spend a dollar on really horrible stuff, too.
Hey, speaking of audio, one last question from me. You've had really good luck with the audio versions of your books when it comes to performance and narration and stuff like that. And I'm just curious, I tend to ask authors, what is your take on audiobooks, and how well do you think you've been treated audiobook-wise when it comes to adaptations?
I think I've been treated very well. I'm real happy with Audible. I actually had an audio version of Hitler's Angel early on when the first draft of that, or the first, when it came out in the United States in 1998. And that was a good version, too. So I've been really lucky. And strangely enough, I'm quite picky because I used to work in radio. So it's uh-huh. been real luck for me, and I've had nothing to do with who the readers are. I've had nothing to do, you know, with the voice casting or anything else. I've just ended up with really good people. In fact, the gentleman Jay Snyder, who did Retrieval Artist, would call me to ask how a lot of the names were pronounced. And at one point, I finally said to him, "You know, Jay, I'm the only person on the planet who knows the correct pronunciation of those names. So if you say them wrong, it's not going to offend me." It's not going to offend the readers. And he said, "Yes, I know, but I want it to be exactly right." And I really appreciated that.
Do you ever mess with someone, and if the name has like an X in it, you say, "You pronounce this as an Javier."
Yes, sometimes I do. I had way too much language training. So occasionally I figure, oh, this name is pronounced in the French manner.
Well, we would be remiss if we didn't ask you, and I know that John wanted to bring this up, ask you about the Freelancer Survival Guide and the Business Rush.
Okay.
John?
Yes, I think you just asked it. tell us about the Business Rush.
Well, let me tell you about both, actually. About 2 years ago, a long time ago, actually, I wanted to write a nonfiction book for business people, for freelancers in particular, and I never got around to it. I'd get like a chapter done, and then I'd think, oh, I'm going to write a novel now, or go to something, what Dean calls bright and shiny. And I kept thinking, well, perhaps I should try to get a book contract on this, and I never did. And then my friend Michael J. Totten, who has a blog, he also has a book coming out, but he is an international correspondent, independent, and he just does it on his blog. He writes about the Mideast and travels over there funded through his blog. And so I was having lunch with him and a YA writer named Scott William Carter one day, and I asked them, you know, how do you go about setting up a blog? Because I thought, with the recession going on, this is the time most people are going to lose their jobs, and then they're going to just try to go freelance, and it's going to be hard, and they're going to make these horrible mistakes on top of having just lost their job. And this was the time for the book to be out, and I didn't try 2 years before to actually sell it, so I thought I'd put it for free on my blog. And both Scott and Michael gave me really good advice on how to do this, and I started, and it mushroomed. The actual Freelancer Survival Guide is 200,000 words now that it's actually in a print volume, and I thought I'd be able to cut it, and there wasn't a lot to cut. When I finished doing it, I was writing it every week on my blog. My readers said, "Now what are we going to do on Thursdays?" And they said, "Please keep doing something on business." So I started another column, and then all this change in publishing started to happen rapidly with the electronic publishing and borders going down and the distributors going away and all the various changes. And they asked me what my take on it was. So I thought, okay, I'll start a relatively short piece on that. And it turns out I thought it'd be done by now. And I'm only just, I've been working kind of backwards. I started with the big publishers, with the general changes, and then I went to big publishers and small publishers and independent publishers. And then I went to best-selling writers and mid-list writers, and now I'm in what I think is going to happen with beginning writers, which is proving quite difficult for me because it's still in such flux that my opinions change week to week. But it's an exciting time to be in this publishing business, and it's an exciting time to be writing about it. And I've been on a streak now, posting something nonfiction on my blog every Thursday since the beginning of April 2009, and I'm unwilling to break the streak.
Wow.
So I had one last question.
Sure.
So you're a voracious reader, a prolific author who writes across genres, and you're someone who's tuned into the business side of things. So I'm curious what your take would be on the current state of sci-fi and fantasy, or specifically, is there a certain type of story that you'd like to see more of in the genre? Are we doing too many, say, urban fantasies or some certain type of story? Or what's your take there?
There's always stories that get lost. And, you know, when a particular kind of story gets real hot, then other stories go away. What I'm not seeing as much as I want to see are the kind of thing that George Martin's writing right now, which is, not really, it's high fantasy, but it's politically based. It's almost like historical fiction. And I think George is one of the few people who's doing it and doing it well. It's hard to do well. You know, alternate world fantasy is what I used to call it when I edited the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, where the world is as rigorously developed as a science fiction world. And right now with the rise of urban fantasy, that's not getting its due. It'll change. It always does. And we'll see what happens now with, again, the rise of electronic publishing. And we'll see what we're going to actually see is what the readers want to read as opposed to what publishers think the readers want to read. Because publishing, book publishing, is 2 to 3 years out. And so when you're trying to sell a book into New York, for example, the editors or the sales force will say, well, you know, this is not something that's going to interest readers. And essentially, they're guessing. They're guessing what readers are going to want to read 3 years out. And with the changes, you can put a book up and suddenly readers will flock to it. It's happening with Amanda Hocking right now. She's writing some very scary YA novels, and not scary in the way of The Hunger Games or anything else, but just, you know, kind of the old Stephen King terrifying horror novels as a YA novel. And she was told that these books couldn't fly. No kid would want to read them. And obviously, you know, by the time they came out.
Every kid would want to read them.
Hmm?
I think every kid would want to read them.
Oh, I think every kid wants to read them. And every adult, if you pick up the first one, it's impossible to put down.
I used to go to the video store renting all the horror movies when I was a kid.
Oh, I did too. One of the seminal experiences of my childhood, and anybody who's my age, was that they put the birds on television. And yep. I live on the Oregon coast. Okay, there are gulls everywhere, and I'm terrified still. I was like 6, and I never recovered. But I watched it, and I've watched every scary movie I can since.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I decided I needed when I was getting really scared by these movies. I decided I needed to just get over it and kind of desensitize myself. So I just started watching them until I started realizing, you know, oh, they always do this. Yeah, oh, this always happens. Yeah.
And the pattern gets stuck in your head. Sometimes if I'm going uphill when I'm really dressed up in high heels, I think, you know, if there's a haunted house up here and I have to run away, I'm wearing stupid clothes. And I'm thinking, oh, that came from horror movies. You know, the girl who's in the high heels going up the hill is the one you know is going to die because she can't run away.
Yep. Or, oh, those two kids are having sex.
That's it.
It's the end of them.
Yep. They're dead now.
Yep. That's Joss Whedon's rule as well. You can't have sex without having something really, really bad happen to you afterwards.
Yeah, that's true.
So, Jeff, did you have any other questions?
No, I'm good.
John?
Nope.
All right. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. This has been a real blast. We really appreciate you joining us.
Well, thanks for asking, Patrick. It's been a lot of fun, and it didn't feel like you guys were ganging up on me at all. It was really a good time.
Awesome. Well, do you have, before we go too far, why don't you tell everybody your website?
My website is www.christinecatherinerush.com. And if you have trouble spelling all of my names, and most people do, just go to www.chriswrites.com, and you'll get there the same
and
way.
Are you doing Twitter or Facebook? In fact, I know you're doing Twitter because I follow you and I think you follow me.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook. And I have a fan page on Facebook that's starting up too, because I'm starting to hit my limit of friends or getting there. So yes. A friend of mine is starting up a fan page too on Facebook. So that'll keep things up to date as well.
I'm getting very close to my friend limit on Facebook as well. I think I just got like 1,000 or more to go before I hit it.
Yeah, it's kind of astonishing. me, but it's cool. I really like the whole social media thing. I didn't think I would, and I really like it a lot.
Well, I think it's great that you're embracing it. One of the things that I like to tell authors when I see a site that I like is, you know, good job on your website. I like your site.
Oh, thank you.
It doesn't look like a one of the old GeoCities websites, which a lot of author sites look like, and it really bothers me.
Well, I fixed it this last year, too. It was too cluttered for me, and I wanted it to be a site that I would be happy to go to instead of one that I would go to and kind of cringe. And so I tried to make it less cluttered. And fortunately, you can do that now.
Yes. So before we go, why don't you do a bullet list of what have you got coming out that people can look for?
Well, since the backlist is coming out, they should kind of keep an eye on the electronic stuff, because that's going to happen first.
Okay.
The Disappeared was just reissued, the first Retrieval Artist, and you'll see the Retrieval Artist coming back. You'll see the Fae coming back. The first book of the Fae will be back in about 2 weeks with the spectacular cover. I can hardly wait. The new stuff, the City of Ruins from Pyre is coming out in May, and if you want to read Christine Grayson, my next Christine Grayson, which is called Wickedly Charming, will also be out in May. And that's one book people are going to like, because it's set at the book expo. But, Prince Charming falls in love with the wicked stepmother, and he teaches her why vampires are hot. So it's a very strange little book. And I will have, again, another book coming out of Pyre, Boneyards. Soon after that, and on and on and on. I've got a lot of stuff being reissued.
Lastly, any book signings or conventions coming up?
I'll be at Worldcon. It looks like I will be down at Writers of the Future, and there will be a book signing there. There will also be a book signing in my small town of Lincoln City, Oregon, in May, at the end of the month, at North by Northwest Books. And otherwise, you can contact me through my website. I'm happy to sign any book that you send me with a self-addressed stamped envelope.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate the conversation.
Thanks again to Christine Catherine Rush for coming on the show. We really appreciate that. That was an awesome conversation. And thanks to Chris. Thanks to John DiNardo and Jeff Patterson for joining me this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, there's a couple of things you can do that would help us out. Number one, tell your friends. This helps us to build more listenerships. Number two, you can go out to our iTunes page, give us a couple stars, maybe write us a review. That helps with exposure on iTunes and gives us potential to have more listeners as well. If you had any thoughts or comments about this podcast, there's a couple things you can do. Number one, you can go to the website, sfsignal.com, leave a comment on the post. Number two, you can call our voicemail line, 720-277-9082. And again, on the post, there's a little flash widget. And if you don't want to make a long-distance phone call, you just plug your number into there and Google will call you, which saves you a long-distance phone call. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back next week with another panel and another great interview. Until then, my name is Patrick Hester. I appreciate you guys listening. I will talk to you next week. And in the meantime, read a book and watch Fringe.